It is the morning show. I'm Kay Darcher Kent. We dive into what nutritious, high-quality school lunch means for kids as some states move to provide all students with breakfast and lunch, regardless of family income. Call in with your questions about what's served in school cafeterias, your experiences with school lunches, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And thanks to Jim and Baldwin, who suggested we explore the importance of food in schools and specifically the work of one organization.
A nonprofit called EatReal.org, and they provide nutritionists and dietitians for free for school systems.
Nora Latorre is CEO of Eat Real. That's a California-based national nonprofit helping school districts serve nutritious food to students. Nora, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. And I love that Jim put us on your radar and is sharing about the work that's happening throughout the country.
Yes, we do too. So bring us up to speed now that Congress ended the Free Lunch for All program last year that provided tens of millions of students with meals. How are kids from low-income backgrounds getting meals now?
Yes, so that was a pandemic-era benefit that and investment in children that really worked to create more nutrition security and is a really essential safety net for American children. Universal free meals and better school meals works to create, has been proven to create healthier kids that are better able to focus, learn, grow, and thrive. And now children and families are really struggling. And it's really now that that national investment has gone away, it's going state by state. And so the disparity is huge. It very much depends on states and is, I know Wisconsin thinking about making a bold investment into children's health with universal free meals. Some states, children still have access to universal free meals and that investment is still happening in California, Colorado, and Maine, and Washington and your neighbor, Minnesota, are also considering expanding universal free meals and school meals for every child. So in those states, every child has access to the meal they need, which we think is like good books in a classroom or working breaks on a school bus, essential for their learning. And they're able to get the food that they need without stigma. In other states, it's very much based on income and which some children qualify for free meals still. Some are getting reduced meals and some kids don't qualify, but they probably should based on the income requirements across the nation. So right now there's a ton of disparity and inequity in who is getting free meals and access to nutritious meals at school across our nation.
So it's a very piecemeal approach, what I'm hearing from you. I just want you to reflect for a moment on the Department of Education data from its School Pulse survey showing that students partaking in school lunch programs is down from last school year by like 23% nationally. And the largest drop is here in the Midwest, 31%. What do these drops tell you?
That people were relying on those meals when they were available and accessible and free, people took advantage of those meals and it helped nourish them. I would add that those meals also can help create a stronger economy because schools are the largest restaurant chain in America. They serve 7 billion meals to 30 million kids. If you think about it, there's a school in every town and they are serving the most meals to the most important customers, our students, our children, and those restaurants can source food locally. And there's a movement called Farm to School where they're actually sourcing from local farmers. So when we look at those stats and that meal participation is down, we see that not only are children missing out on meals that they depended on and leveraged last year, but those restaurants, those schools, their numbers are down. So they're sourcing fewer meals and fewer ingredients, which also hurts the economy. So school meals is not only an investment in children and health, but into the local economy. And so we know that for every dollar invested in school meals, that there's over $2 of benefits in terms of health benefits for children and economic benefits, not even including the climate benefit. So it hurts it hurts my heart to hear that, because kids are missing out and the local economies are missing out on helping the best restaurant in town become the best restaurant in town.
We're going to get to climate in just a moment. I'm going to reintroduce you here as we talk about school lunches, nutritious school meals, and the movement we're seeing in some other states for universal free meals at school. We have the Eat Real CEO, Nora LaTorre. You can join in with your questions about school lunches and your experiences. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nora, you estimate, as you said, that American schools serve 7 billion meals to 30 million students every year. What is the connection? What's the link between these meals and learning for young people?
Meals are a lifeline for families and for children. School meals are a safety net in America. Many children depend on 30 to 100% of their calories for school meals. There's not only school lunch that's served, which I think a lot of people remember, there's school breakfast and sometimes school dinner. And so school meals are a place where kids can get the nourishment that they need. And it's been proven to be one of the healthiest places that kids could have access to delicious food. And so kids really need it in order at a critical moment where their bodies are growing, their brains are growing, and good food affects how they feel immediately, whether or not they have a tummy ache and need to go to the nurse's office, whether or not they can perform in sports after school, whether or not their frontal cortex is growing in a healthy way so that they have, you know, executive function and can focus and can learn and develop. And so school meals are key to supporting healthy, happy, growing kids. I think, and they're key to a brighter future in America.
What is your response to lawmakers who say that the free lunch for all and the free breakfast for all, giving meals to kids who don't need such a benefit is wasteful spending in that regard?
I think our children are the most important thing in the world, and there are and we need to be making more investments. I would say that every child needs healthy meals at school and every child, because we have a perfect storm happening right now in America, and we have a massive children's health crisis that people aren't talking about. So school meals are an incredible way to get healthy, delicious, sustainable, culturally relevant meals to every child, and to create more equality where there's no stigma happening, where some kids get a meal and some kids don't get a meal, or some kids get this quality of a meal and some kids get that quality meal, and some kids get school lunch debt and then are shamed because of that. Like, it is an amazing way to just make a consistent investment in nutrition for our children.
How much of an issue is lunch shaming of students who have unpaid meal debt and can't afford their lunch?
We heard stories before the pandemic that were crushing about that, and communities coming together to fundraise to cover school lunch debt. And we're starting to hear those stories again. So it is a big problem in the lunchroom. We think the lunchroom is a classroom, and when there's school lunch shaming happen, it creates a really unhealthy classroom environment.
Nora LaTorre,
with a lot of judgment.
Nora LaTorre leads Eat Real. It's an organization advocating for nutritious food access, improving the food served in schools. Call in with questions and comments about school meals and what you'd support serving to kids. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the ripple effects of billions of school lunches served up in schools each year, what it means to serve nutritious, high-quality offerings, and how kids get access to these meals. Call in with your questions, your thoughts about school lunches, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nora LaTorre leads the national advocacy organization Eat Real and stays with us. Nora, we heard from Mike in Milwaukee, called in to ask how people who have never experienced food insecurity in their lives can better understand this issue. How do we develop empathy for children and families who lack regular access to good food?
I really appreciate that question. I think there's two things. There's food insecurity in America, and there's nutrition insecurity, and what we need in America is nutrition insecurity. And while some Americans haven't experienced food insecurity, many Americans are experiencing nutrition insecurity, where people don't have access to the delicious and nutritious, nutrient-dense meals that they need. Actually, in America today, 93% of Americans are cardiometabolically sick. That means about only 7% of people are walking around feeling really good. A lot of Americans don't feel great. And the number one cause of shortened health span and lifespan in America is processed food-related disease. And so people across America don't have access to the nutritious food that they need to live long, healthy, happy lives. So most Americans are experiencing actual nutrition issues. And so that's one thing to think about.
It's more widespread than we think, is what you're saying.
Yes.
There.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And we have a lot of kids' health issues coming up now because of processed food-related disease. It's much more widespread than people realize. There's a lot of unseen nutrition insecurity. And so during the pandemic, actually type 2 diabetes in children, which is a preventable processed food-related disease, went up 76% in children. So our children are also getting sicker. And so we actually have a children's health crisis, and it's impacting tons of kids, not just kids that don't have food access, but especially those kids. And so, so high level, I think that this is a much bigger issue than people are talking about, and it's impacting people that people know. Like, this is impacting your neighbors. And then I think it's really important to think about, how do you have empathy, and how do you understand, and maybe think about when you just didn't have. You get hungry, where you just, didn't have a meal because of you're busy or something, and how that made you feel. Like, think of a personal moment where you didn't have access to something you need, and how that made you feel, how that physically made you feel, how that mentally made you feel, how it made you worry, how it made you stressed, how it took up your time, your mental capacity, how it broke your heart, maybe you couldn't get your kids a snack that they needed, and then what that does to you as a parent. Like, try to make it personal and put yourself in some shoes. Think through what that would feel like, and you'll start to realize quickly, that food is a human right, and that everyone deserves to have access to food that they need to live.
Let's look more closely at what's on the lunch menu. Our Governor Tony Evers, in his state budget proposal plan, it would give schools an extra 10 cents per meal to include locally sourced foods. And I just want to get your take on that. How practical is it to source local food for schools, and what are the cost differences?
It is so powerful to source local food from school. There's a massive farm to school movement that's happening in the United States that's being led by the USDA, and that states are making investment in, and it works. It is possible. I eat school lunch and crave school lunch. Actually, it can be that good. I eat it every week, and I look forward to it. I look forward to having school meals that feature that seasonal vegetable that the school was able to source, or that a school, maybe a farmer locally called up and said, I have a surplus, which is partly how this whole program was started in 1946. I have a surplus of this amazing vegetable. Would you buy it from me? And the school, nutrition director says, yes, I'll buy it. I'm going to expose the children for the first time to this vegetable of local peas or whatever it is. And it's a really powerful way to create a stronger local economy, and then to also educate and inspire students around vegetables. Today, only 7% of children get the daily recommended amount of vegetables. So when I talk about nutrition insecurity, kids aren't getting those nutrients that they need from vegetables. And so that investment that the Wisconsin government is considering to sourced locally is a huge investment in local economies and re-regionalizing and strengthening our economy and our food supply chains, as well as educating children and helping them learn to love real food and nourish themselves and local food.
I want to pick up on 1946. You mentioned that year when Congress established the National School Lunch Program to address malnutrition in schools. If you could change something today about this program, what would it be?
I think making sure that people know that it works, that we all feel proud of it, that we see it like it's books, that we see it like it's a good teacher, that we really invest in real change in the cafeteria, and that we as a society lift it up and champion it. And like Jim, who called into your show, really advocate for using it as a platform to invest in our children, invest in our local economy. So I think it's making sure that it's seen as one of the most important investments of our country by society.
We're talking about school lunches and nutritious school meals with Eat Real CEO Nora LaTorre. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Jenny in Elkhorn wants to know, Nora, about the high levels of sugar in cereal bars that a lot of kids are eating for breakfast. What can you tell us?
Yeah, thank you for asking that question, Jenny. It's really, really important. So today in America, children eat about a bathtub of added sugar a year. We've noticed that in American breakfast, orange juice that doesn't have fiber, so that's free sugar, breakfast muffin and some flavored yogurt, kids can get over four times the amount of added sugar they're supposed to have the entire day. So breakfast and spiking kids with sugar can hurt their focus. It affects their metabolism, it affects their growth. It's really important that we as a society look at added sugar and take it really seriously. You know, we our program, we look at the nutrition and sustainability of school food. We help school leaders look at all the recipes, all their ingredients, the amounts of sugar, how local things are, how nutrient-dense things are, et cetera. And then we help them make a roadmap to make changes to continue to raise the bar for that food. And sugar is one thing that we do look at. We remove over 15 pounds of sugar per student per year out of school meals. It's hidden in everything. There are over 260 names for sugar. It is throughout our food system. Over 67% of kids' calories are ultra processed. Like it is, and sugar is hidden in so much of it. So it's a serious problem, and we need to raise the bar across the nation. Right now, there are new nutritional national standards that are being proposed. And in California, they just announced Senator Skinner sponsored a bill to set standards in California that would look at sugar and reduce sugar so that kids weren't getting over the daily recommended amount of sugar. So I think it's a really powerful moment, because for the first time, the nation and states are looking at higher standards, and standards that for the first time include sugar. Like there have been higher standards, and those have been proven to work, but they've never included sugar. And so we need people to raise their voice for sugar standards and right now at the national level and the state level.
But Nora, how do you raise the bar on, less sugar, less salty, and less nutritionally deficient meals when you've got districts dealing with, staffing crunches, supply chain issues for their cafeteria, when their budgets are really being squeezed, and the impact of inflation? These are all competing forces to be able to give kids the best meals possible. How do you grapple with that?
Yeah, it's hard. And nutrition directors, we think they're superheroes. Their jobs are hard. It's complicated. They're navigating so much, and they're so important. They're feeding our children. So we think, support your local nutrition director, champion them. And then we need to advocate for more investment in school meals and higher standards at the national and state level. But giving the schools, those leaders, then the resources they need and the investment that they need to make those changes and those reimbursements and whatnot. And there, I will say that there are some ways that districts can make swaps that aren't super time or labor intensive, that aren't super expensive either, that they can upgrade. And that's what our eReal program does, is really help them, those nutrition directors, and district by district, make those changes and create a plan that works for the constraints that they're facing.
Nora, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and for having this important conversation. And thank you, Wisconsin, for continuing to invest in school meals for every child.
Nora LaTorre is CEO of Eat Real. That's a California-based national nonprofit helping school districts serve nutritious food to students. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Soot is a dangerous pollutant, and it increases the risk of asthma and other health problems. A proposed rule change by the federal government could tighten standards around soot. Call in with your questions about a tiny toxic pollutant inhaled daily, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Victoria Gillet is an internal medicine physician in Milwaukee. Dr. Gillet, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, happy to be here.
Good morning. And Dr. Joel Charles is a family medicine physician in Viroqua. Dr. Charles, welcome.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having us.
Well, let's start with you, Dr. Charles. You practice in a rural part of the state where some people might think that air pollution isn't an issue. What health impacts are you encountering from air pollution, especially in your practice?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the first most important thing here is that, you know, air pollution really doesn't just respect rural-urban divides. It can spread long distances, including across states. So definitely seeing impacts in my patient in rural Southwest, my patients in rural Southwest Wisconsin, anywhere from, you know, impacts on early pregnancy all the way through the end of people's lives. We know that pollution from fossil fuels, including these small particulates, also known as soot, can cross the placenta, get into the bloodstream through the lungs. And so they can cause preterm births, stillbirths, asthma in children, delayed cognitive development in children. They can cause cancer, emphysema or COPD, heart disease, and dementia. So as a family doc, I take care of people across the whole spectrum of their lives, and I'm constantly aware of the fact that, you know, my patients are being made more sick by the fact that we burn fossil fuels and are producing this pollution, and the fact that it's avoidable.
But how do you know it's the air pollution that is the culprit and not a family history or a predisposition to a health complication?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's a question that's really at the key of sort of why we're pushing for tighter standards here. And the point is that there's almost never any single cause for a problem. Mm. Sort of the more advanced we've gotten in medicine and public health, the more we've been able to sort of fine tune, figure out where things are coming from and that there are many different causes. So when we look at a population as a whole, we know essentially that everybody's health is impacted by soot, primarily from burning fossil fuels. And so, yeah, to your point, I couldn't point at a single patient and say, this kid's asthma attack is entirely from soot. I can also say that when I look at all of my patients, if we weren't burning fossil fuels and if there wasn't as much soot in the air, that there would be much less asthma in my community, for example.
Dr. Gillet, you practice in Northwest Milwaukee. How do you encounter air pollution affecting your patients?
Some of the circumstances are similar to what Joel described. We're like, I can't prove that this is because of pollution, but I feel confident. You know, I have some patients who don't smoke, who are on every single asthma and COPD medication available to them, and they still have residual symptoms. And there's not much in the way of a genetic predisposition, especially to things like COPD. And if you really can't get any better, even once you stop smoking and everything else, there's really good evidence that there's something environmental that's causing problems. But I was reminded, I had sort of forgotten about this before, but back, you may remember, we had this COVID pandemic and it had us all stay home. And we thought we were going to be able to just stay home for 3 weeks and that would be it. And people got outside, people were feeling better. They were still coming into the doctor for things. And then we all got back on the roads. And the number of asthma exacerbations that I saw in my clinic in that moment, as people got back on the streets and we started putting air pollution into the air again, it felt meaningful. Hmm. So I really have seen, it does seem to make a difference whether people are near a street, whether they're near idling cars, whether they're near a factory. I do see differences in people's breathing symptoms in particular. That's the most direct thing that we see, though all those other consequences that Joel talked about, we can see in the data, though it's much harder to pull, you've been, near an idling car and therefore you had complications with your pregnancy.
Can you explain why people of color breathe more hazardous air?
Oh, gosh. Yes. Well, I can explain some of the reasons. As with everything in equity, it's multifaceted. But a really simple example is, I was trying to think about how to protect my patients who have these really terrible lung complaints. What do I do to minimize their exposure to pollution? And when you think about how they should get around from place to place, actually, the worst thing that you can do is walk alongside a busy street. The best thing that you can do to protect you yourself from air pollution to get from place to place is driving in a single occupancy vehicle. That's also the thing that is most contributing to the particle pollution that we see and soot in the streets. And so my African-American patients, because in Milwaukee, these are also people who on average are much less likely to be able to own their own vehicle. They're more likely to use public transportation and have alternate means of transit. They're making less pollution. And then because they're using alternate means of transportation, they're breathing in the pollution that other people produce. And obviously that's sort of on average over individuals. There's also this interesting phenomenon that cities that are more integrated, that experience less segregation, actually have less air pollution, presumably because the way that we change zoning laws. And so not only, we think about inequities in pollution exposure, but just if we were a more sort of taking care of everybody's society, we would have less of these pollutant effects.
We're talking about the efforts to tighten the standards for soot pollution and what is happening at the EPA. We have Dr. Victoria Gillet, who practices in Milwaukee, and Dr. Joel Charles, who practices in Viroqua. You can join in on particle pollution experiences, questions, 800-642-1234. Dr. Charles, the EPA is considering, as we mentioned, strengthening its standards for soot pollution. It's also called particulate pollution. Can you give us a better explainer here what is considered soot pollution and where it comes from?
Yeah, so not to get too technical, but so essentially pretty much mostly it comes from burning things, primarily fossil fuels from a lot of different sources. So vehicles, especially heavy duty vehicles, but also sort of passenger vehicles, coal plants, any sort of electrical generation that involves combustion. Agriculture is a big source in Wisconsin, a mix of sort of the vehicles involved, but also just the production of dust. And then industry in Wisconsin, primarily from burning fossil fuels, but some other sources as well. So that pollution goes up into the air, can spread long distances, and it basically gets into people's lungs. This, but particularly with soot, we're talking about pieces that are smaller than 2.5 microns. So that's small enough to cross through the lungs into the bloodstream, into the brain, cross the placenta, so affect fetuses. So, and as I mentioned, that can have really wide-ranging impacts.
Why do you think is the EPA acting now on soot pollution? Is there something new or changing in the research body?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think they're acting because action is overdue, frankly. So we've been, you know, the Clean Air Act was passed over 50 years ago and is probably one of the most successful policies that, that America has ever enacted. It saves millions of lives a year. And in terms of benefits to society, the benefits outweigh the costs of improving air quality typically by about 30 to 1. And it's been 12 years since the EPA has updated these standards. And what's changed in that time is that the better we get at science, the more we realize that there is no safe level of soot. At the same time, the technology we have to avoid that soot is getting better and cheaper. So clean energy is now the cheapest option. And so we know that there's no safe level of this pollution. We know we have the technology we need to avoid it. So it's really a no-brainer to do it. The question is, how quickly are we going to improve those standards? So currently the EPA has a standard of sort of an average of 35 micrograms per cubic meter spread over a year, and a level of 12 over 24 hours. And they said the lowest they consider is 25 over a year and 8 over 24 hours. And we are asking people to contact the EPA and ask them to set those lower standards of 25 and 8. And they can do that by going to wiclimatehealth.org/soot. That's S-O-O-T.
Let's take a call now. Jim is joining us in Camp Douglas. Jim, hi. What is your question?
My question is, how do you compute the quality of air in an area that is being checked out or evaluated so that I get a better understanding of how you get your numbers for telling those types of data?
So air that is perhaps next to a plant or a manufacturing plant versus air that is somewhere else. Dr. Gillet, could you field that?
Yeah, I think that we'll see if Joel can support me on some of the technical things, but there are air quality monitors scattered throughout the United States. There are some that are officially put there by the federal government, and then people can also buy their own. There's purple air quality monitors that we use sometimes in our research. And they measure the total volume of various different types of pollutants. We're talking about soot today, but we also care about ozone and nitrous oxide. And they measure them depending on what the meaningful concentration is for health and the amount of the pollutant that is in the air, usually in something like parts per million. So, you know, how many individual pieces of soot are there in a million pieces of air? Sort of a weird concept. Mm-hmm. And we then try to assess, you know, what's a level that is harmful to human health. As Joel mentioned, with soot, there is no level that is safe. Those air monitors are not uniformly distributed across the state or within a city, and there's tons of variation depending on how close you are to a point source like a factory or a farm that's kicking up lots of dust and has a diesel-powered engine doing a lot of the work. And so part of the benefit of a big federal legislation like this is that you don't have to be as dependent on exactly what's happening near you. You know that everyone is moving towards this future of a less polluted air source.
There's more uniformity.
Right. And it's still on average, you know, we're still not getting to a perfect. You should still be aware of what the point sources of pollution are around you. And it's worthwhile for you to check. There's this website, airnow.gov, where you can track what the level of pollutants are that are particularly high in whatever that closest federal air quality monitoring station is to understand how risky the air in your area is on a given day.
That's interesting. Physicians Victoria Gillet in Milwaukee and Joel Charles in Viroqua guiding us through the health consequences of one of the deadliest air pollutants, that is soot. Call in with your questions about air quality and the effects of breathing in soot on your health, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Environmental Protection Agency proposes tougher air quality standards for soot pollution. We have a pair of Wisconsin physicians helping us understand the health implications of breathing in particulate pollution. Call in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Family medicine physician in Viroqua, Joel Charles, and internal medicine specialist Victoria Gillet in Milwaukee. They stay with us. Let's go to Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I'm wondering, is there data available to show how the, as you call it, soot content in the air has changed over the, I'll say, decades? Our cars are much cleaner today here in southeast Wisconsin. We need to emissions test our vehicles before we can renew a license. There's many less coal-fired power plants in existence, and the ones that are have scrubbers to remove sulfur dioxide and things like that. Natural gas, I'm sure somebody could point out data that says it creates particulate, but it's got to be substantially less than coal, with much more of our power coming from natural gas. How has the particulate content in our air have changed over the years, and how does that correlate to what we've seen for health issues? I'm assuming we've got a decrease of particulates, but yet we're saying there's an increase of health issues. So
Jeff,
how do those
numbers
jive?
That great question, Jeff. Thank you so much for laying that out. And Dr. Charles, I'm going to toss that to you on how to document those changes and that progress.
Yeah, absolutely. So your question is a key one. And what it gets at is that the question always in health is like, what's reasonably achievable with the tools that we have at hand for a given person or a population? So we've definitely seen major improvements in air quality over the last 50 years. I think it's been one of the great triumphs of public health and public policy that we've done that. And it has had huge benefits for public health, and it's saving millions of lives a year. So no question, we've made progress through as you mentioned, sort of decreasing the pollution coming out of coal plants, but also improving the pollution coming out of vehicles and other sources. But the question really is there more that we can gain? Can we save more lives? And is that going to cost us? And the answer is that if the EPA passes tighter standards, probably 20,000 premature deaths are going to be avoided each year in the U.S. So then the next question is, well, what's that going to cost us? And the answer is that cleaner energy is cheaper. So really, there's only one coal plant in the U.S. that it wouldn't make sense financially for it to be replaced by renewable energy. So every coal plant in the U.S., it would be cheaper to just build new renewables and shut that plant down. Similarly, lifetime costs for EVs are cheaper than internal combustion vehicles already, and the price of those vehicles is coming down. So 2 points there. We have more health gains that we can get. We can stop asthma attacks, stop heart attacks for some people, and we can save money doing it. We have the technology. So it's really just a no-brainer to keep improving it. And why wouldn't we want that?
Tom emailed Dr. Gillet to ask how much pollution and health problems are caused by gas stoves and fireplaces that are not vented to the outside, and how do you keep particle levels inside your home lower?
That is a really excellent question that we don't talk about nearly as much, in particular when we think about federal regulation, because thankfully the government is mostly not coming into our homes and telling us exactly what we should do in there on the day-to-day basis. That being said, those sources are actually very dangerous. And many of the pulmonary impacts of what you, sort of the risk that you have to your own lungs in particular, is mostly determined by what you do in your own homes. And so anything that's in your home that burns, that isn't adequately vented to the outdoors, has significant impacts on your pulmonary health and all of those other things that soot pollution cause. Things as small as a candle actually do put soot into your air, though not very much. And so then you can imagine what a poorly ventilated gas burning stove or a wood burning fireplace also puts a lot of this soot into the air as well. So those are significant consequences and negative impacts on pulmonary, cardiovascular, reproductive health. And that's probably the biggest thing that you as an individual can do to protect your own health, is to make sure everything that you have is adequately ventilated, and as much as possible, switch out things that use energy from burning combustion to something that's electrified. The most classic example, and one that is pretty hot in media right now, is switching out a gas stove for an induction stove. People get worked up, like I said, about people coming in, the government coming into your home and telling you what to do. But sort of irrespective of that, you should do what's right for your health, which is to make that switch.
Dr. Victoria Gillet practices in Milwaukee. Dr. Joel Charles here, a practice in Viroqua. You can join in on soot pollution, 800-642-1234. Chris is here in Manitowoc. Chris, hi.
Hello. One of the things that we see, like taking our dog for a walk in the morning and just driving around the countryside in this rural community, is burning of garbage. And, you know, people are burning plastics, they're basically burning everything that's the waste from their homes. So I'm wondering, first of all, what impact that has on human health. And then secondly, I believe that is illegal, but it's not being enforced whatsoever. And is there something that can be done, you know, statewide at least, to reduce that impact on our communities?
Chris, thank you. Dr. Charles, burning garbage in our last minute together.
Yes, something I definitely see from time to time here. I mean, there's no question that burning garbage is going to damage your health and the health of your neighbors, and I really wouldn't recommend that people do it. I'm not an expert on sort of exactly how it's regulated or what portion is contributing to air pollution in Wisconsin as a whole, but, you know, one of the best way, you know, if you're going to burn stuff, you need to burn it super hot, and people just can't get the temperatures to decrease the pollution from that. So I really recommend people don't do that. And if you want your neighbors not to do it, I think it comes down to organizing with your neighbors to sort of get your community to sort of push each other not to do it.
Organizing with your neighbors in our last moments together, do you see political will for stricter regulation of pollution?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you look at polling, whether you're conservative or progressive, support for improved air quality standards are north of 70%, especially now that we have the technology to do it and to save money doing it. So it's really a no-brainer.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thank you.
Dr. Victoria Gillet is an internal medicine physician practicing in Milwaukee. Dr. Joel Charles, family medicine physician in Viroqua. Both are active with the environmental group Wisconsin Health Professionals for Climate Action. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.